Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Am I audible on this machine? Welcome to this discussion. Whether it's a seminar, a confrontation, a head-to-head, or simply a gentle walk through the topic, we'll have to see. I have the pleasant task simply of introducing speakers, sitting and listening. You clearly know who they are, so I'm not going to take time introducing them, or you wouldn't be here. But the format we're going to adopt is that Conor Geaghty is going to present his paper, in which he has some interesting ideas to float about the relationship between human rights, democracy, and civil liberties. And that's something that I think is of real concern, not merely as a matter of terminology, but a matter of substance. And I'll then ask, in turn, Francesca Klug and Andrew Padifat to give their reactions to Conor's paper before I throw the issues open for questions or discussion as you wish. We'll be finishing by 7:30. A, because we have to finish at a civilized time anyway, and B, because this being Holocaust Memorial Day, some of you will know that there's a concert in the Shaw Library on the sixth floor, which begins at 7:30. Some of you may well want to go to that. For those of you who don't move on, however, and have the time, there's a reception for you all following this seminar, to which you're all cordially invited. That's taking place in the Robinson Room on the third floor. Let me first then turn to Conor Geaghty and ask him to present his paper.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Can I just check everyone can hear me? Good. Your hand up shows you can rather than... Oh, good. Excellent. It's great there's so many of you here. I know that when it's cold outside, the number of people at our seminars increases, so there's obviously a great disincentive to leave. The usual disincentive to leave early is that you miss the drinks, but today you also freeze, so we have a captive audience. We also have an ethical dilemma for you all. At the end, you walk up the stairs, and you come to a point when you are confronted by the possibility of a drinks party or the memorial concert. Now, fortunately, we have to go to the drinks party, so our ethical crisis is resolved. But it'll be interesting to see how many of you resolve this and in what way. So we do hope to see you at the drinks party afterwards. We've put the words human rights in the title so that you will come. It used to be information technology when I was at university was the one that got all the grants, and human rights now gets all the people. But my talk, and Francesca and Andrew will repair the damaging omissions in my talk by referring to human rights. I put two references to human rights in order to establish that I am aware of their existence. Mine is mainly about civil liberties and democracy. And what I want to do is I want to try and map out some territory and raise some questions about the meaning of the idea of civil liberties and how it connects with democracy, and then perhaps developing from that where the language of human rights fits. And I was very pleased to hear Stephen say that this is an issue of great practical importance. I must say I feel that very strongly myself. I feel a bit embarrassed that a very long time ago I wrote an article in the New Statesman in, a good number of years ago, talking about how there was a police state in Britain, how fundamental freedoms have been fundamentally eroded and fundamentally destroyed, etc., over the Public Order Act 1986. And we felt the same thing about the Police and Criminal Evidence Bill in 1983. We thought Leon Britton was the most repressive Home Secretary. And now we think of that bill as a kind of absolute paragon of liberty. So what has been going on? Well, what's been going on to some extent, which I'm a bit nervous about, is people like me have been saying for a very long time, we are about to become a police state. And eventually, in a way, possibly, when things really serious things happen, people might say, oh, well, he's been saying that for years. So there's a serious question here about language. And there is tensions in the meaning of civil liberties that I want to explore with you. So I'll talk for maybe 15 or 20 minutes or so, and then I think it's going to be Francesca and then Andrew, as you've heard. So It's a language of civil liberties and democracy. I want to think also through how they've been affected by the new anti-terrorism war, which has made the subject, I think, more important than it had been in the past. Because obviously that war is stretching into the indefinite future. And more to the point, it seems to have been fought partly, or at least some might say ostensibly, in the name of democracy, freedom, and human rights. So we must get the language right for that reason too. There's a lot going on out there, supposedly in the name of these three things, which we don't feel, I don't feel able to control. At the end of my talk, I'll be implicitly critical of the way this language is being used at the moment. I will suggest ways in which a rival model of democracy and civil liberties, which is, I would say, historically well-founded and possible, might be perhaps rescued. It hasn't yet been destroyed by the repressive atmosphere that's been introduced after 11 September. So that's the agenda. Let me start with the idea of civil liberties. On the left, and among liberals generally, civil liberties and the need for their protection are taken almost for granted as a good thing. But it's a very problematic term. Now, there's an excellent article on the relationship between liberty and security in the post-September 11 age by, I think, one of the best political philosophers writing today, Jeremy Waldron, published in the Journal of Applied Philosophy. Journal of Political Philosophy. And he identifies four meanings to civil liberties. And I want to take you through them, because this is in a kind of way as the text. Jeremy says, the first of these is straightforward. Civil liberties are certain freedoms understood as actions that individuals might wish to perform, which it is thought the state should not restrict. I want to do this, you shouldn't stop me. Freedom of speech, religious freedom, freedom of travel, maybe. Into this category there are others. That's discrete and separate from the second, which is a bit vaguer and refers to more diffuse anxieties about governmental power. Now, these anxieties are not driven by any sense of a privileged type of action which individuals should be allowed to perform. So they're not like the first one. It's more driven by a mistrust of government. The government's ability to listen in on telephone conversations is a civil liberties concern, even though, as Jeremy Waldron says, the liberty in question, sometimes referred to as privacy, does not amount to very much more than the condition of not being subjected to scrutiny. So privacy reflects merely a statement, leave me alone. So that's the second of his four categories. The third, then, we also use the term civil liberties as a branch of criminal justice. We say it refers to procedural rights and powers which we think individuals should have when the state detains them or brings charges against them or plans to punish them. These are rights like the right not to be detained without trial, the right to a fair trial process, the right to counsel, and so on. So those are three. The fourth is the rights associated with democracy and civic participation. Those are the four. Now let's look a bit more closely at them. The third of them, the provision of procedural safeguards for suspected criminals, is very important. But surely it is a discrete topic, better regarded for present purposes, for this lecture, as a different subject, a branch of criminal justice, on which views as to the balance as between justice and the individual may legitimately vary, but upon which the core health of our civil liberties does not generally depend, in my argument. It's a separate area. How we treat people under police questioning or when they are otherwise suspected of a crime is an important matter, but one that is different from, for example, how we police political marches and demonstrations. I say that because quite a lot of people seem to regard any changes in the current balance between the individual and the state in the criminal area as an affront to civil liberties. And because that is frequently an unpopular view, and because it is frequently a view with which many, many people disagree profoundly, the impression is given that civil liberties is a kind of absolutist commitment to a particular brand of safeguards which cannot be changed under any circumstances whatsoever, and which therefore seems to be an extreme position. So we have to be careful that that doesn't swallow up the whole subject of civil liberties. I want to leave it to one side for now, but people might want to come back to it in questions. Andrew and Francesca might. The first two of Waldron's definitions are radically different from and in contradiction to some extent of the fourth. So civil liberties carries within itself some kind of radical tension, and that's what I want to explore now. The first two were concerned with asserting individual freedom at the expense of state power. Each involves a strong presumption against executive action. Their model of the world is highly individualistic, and insofar as this is a kind of freedom and liberty that people have in mind when they talk about human rights, then so too is human rights rooted in individualism. Now, there's a lot to be said for having a presumption in favor of liberty, for requiring governmental action to be justified. That's clear. I don't dispute that for one moment. But this perspective on civil liberties and human rights, emphasizing individual freedom as a matter almost of ideological commitment, almost as a fetish, should not be carried too far, lest it seem to come close to the idea of opposing governmental action as such. The government wants to do it, therefore it's wrong. The second category of residual liberty is particularly vulnerable in this regard. Marx's criticism of the idea of human rights as involving a world of isolated monads intent only on doing what they desire without any interference from anybody is in point here. Now, I want to sum up the first two of these definitions in Waldron as reflecting what I would call the libertarian tendency in civil liberties. The element in civil liberties that tends to resist governmental power qua governmental power. That is, based on what has been called by Judith Sklar a liberalism of fear. And in this tradition, you'd get this Isaiah Berlin guy with his negative liberty and all that stuff. Now, that's a well-known field. Compare it with the fourth, the rights associated with democracy and civic participation. We can immediately see now that's very different to each of the first three. It believes in the power of the state. It is committed to the democratic state. It favors community activism, talking to people, engaging in politics. Now, people usually only do this if they think there's something worth doing, something worth changing. So this version of civil liberties also generally involves, though it doesn't have to, a belief in the transformative power of the state to bring about a more equal society. So if you want to be neutral, in contrast to the libertarian tendency, you could call this the republican tendency in civil liberties. Those who believe in democracy as a means to a set of egalitarian ends might want to call it a socialist perspective or a socialist tendency. One of the great unresolved issues for me is whether democracy is an end in itself or a means to an end. But this republican perspective on civil liberties emphasizes not liberty and freedom as such, but the right to vote, freedom of political expression, and, this is the essential point, the sovereign power of the legislator to act on behalf of the people. There's not much point in having all these free speech rights and all these political rights and the right to vote and everything if the legislator can do nothing. So the Republicans are keen on parliamentary sovereignty, on the power of the representative legislator to decide for its people what should be done. They are relaxed, therefore, perhaps even enthusiastic for a strong executive arm of the state. Where libertarians see the state invading liberty, they see a legitimate intrusion into privilege for the good of all. The libertarian shouts, "Leave me alone, stop invading in my liberty." The Republican answers, "That's not liberty, that's license, and we need to regulate for the good of all." So there's a commitment to liberty in these Republicans, but it's less fixed, more easily rebutted than in the first tendency. Historically, people committed to this perspective of civil liberties have mistrusted the judicial branch. And they've mistrusted it because they have suspected judges to be more committed to the libertarian than they would like. They have also, these Republicans, historically mistrusted the language of human rights for the same reason. Though I have to say in passing, the UK Human Rights Act, in my view, far more closely resembles the Republican perspective on civil liberties than it does the libertarian. It's a point that some of my colleagues might want to develop, contradict or pick up or explore. Now, working through the implications of these two perspectives on civil liberties has become more important than ever since 11 September, because there's a large problem in the Republican tendency. And that large problem is something I'll return to at the end of this talk in the context of 11 September. But there's a missing element in the picture. I want to complete the picture of civil liberties by introducing a third tendency. This version believes in all four of Waldron's definitions, but only for certain people. It is an important tendency within civil liberties that has been more powerful in the past than it is today, but which has never finally disappeared. It's committed to liberty, committed to freedom, committed to the political process, but not for everybody, only for some people. Let's call it the exclusivist tendency. Now, this is how civil liberties as a subject got off the ground in the first place. And it was only through hard graft and political struggle that the idea gradually took hold that everybody was entitled to a degree of freedom, and in particular, that everybody was entitled to a share in the democratic system. Unpropertied men and women secured the right to vote, then working people secured the right to associate, and so on. This drive towards equality has been one of the great achievements of the democratic era, and it has rendered the exclusivist perspective on civil liberties a little bit wacky where once it was the mainstream. But it hasn't gone away. It has always been there as a rival voice in civil liberties, one that proclaims a commitment to civil liberties while denying their availability to everybody. This was evident during the two wars during the last century, perhaps forgivably. But looking at the law on civil liberties over the period in the first half of the last century, I was often mystified by the fact that people who were engaged in repressive action against political opponents nevertheless genuinely believed themselves to be committed to civil liberties. They saw no contradiction in, on the one hand, jailing their opponents, and in the other, declaring their commitment to a system rooted in freedom and liberty. They did so because, in the words of the Home Secretary in this country in 1925, he described freedom of speech, defending it as the right to a full propagation of your opinion, provided you do not try to damage the Constitution. He jailed people, the radical opponents that he jailed for subversion were engaged in what the then Home Secretary called the wrong kind of speech. So they were outside the pale. So too were the leaders of the National Unemployed Workers Movement in the 1930s, and so too were people engaged in communist speech during the Cold War. During the Northern Ireland Troubles, there was restriction on the freedom of the Irish politically to communicate, and there was also the media ban on the expression of certain Irish Republican views during the 1980s and the 1990s. So whilst it is to some extent off the mainstream, it's not that far off. There's a thread in our culture which accepts the selectivity of our protection of civil liberties. So let me now turn to 11 September. The power of that moment has been to create conditions, set of circumstances, which have put enormous pressure on the Republican tendency in civil liberties, or the Democratic side of the subject. Now, I'm just talking about the United States, or United Kingdom. I'm not going down the route of analyzing the United States. I wouldn't even begin to assume that there is a Republican tendency within the United States. There's something else going on. But here, you may be disagree with this, it may be difficult for a civil libertarian to say it, but we have in power a government which is broadly speaking, committed to the Republican model of civil liberties. It's partly because we feel very controversial proposals on criminal justice that we assume that they are determined to destroy our civil liberties. And, you know, we may be right about that. But once you think about civil liberties in a Republican sense, you see a government which has, for all its faults, attempted to democratize the system, is engaged in the cut and thrust of democratic politics. This is a good day to be saying that, when the fate of the government hangs on the decisions of a few of its so-called backbench fodder at 7 o'clock this afternoon or this evening. It's a government that's committed to regulation. It's not afraid of big government. Like true Democrats, it is more inclined to see license that needs to be controlled, where the more liberal-minded civil libertarians might detect a basic infringement of civil liberties. So we have a Republican model. It's not all gone, but it's under threat. And the threat is from both sides. And it comes post 11 September. And it's this. There are threats in radically different directions to the Republican model mounted by both the libertarian and the exclusivist tendencies or perspectives. It works like this in my view. The libertarians have been quick to reject out of hand the exercise of anti-terrorism powers because, as I've earlier suggested, they tend by inclination to be opposed in principle or at very least suspicious of the exercise of all governmental power. So that element within the civil liberties tradition which dislikes all government has been quick to see in the reactions of September 11 on the part of government evidence of the perniciousness of the state without really pausing to analyse the democratic credibility of the state or even sometimes the content of the law that's being suggested. The relevant cliche is a kind of knee-jerk negativity. It is not the case of the kind of government that concerns them. It is the very fact of government that seems to make them uneasy. So we have these automatic reactions to government initiatives as leading to a big brother society or a surveillance society, whatever it is. These arguments may be well founded, but it is the easy way in which they are accepted without reflection that causes me to be anxious about this libertarian tendency within civil liberties. We should be very careful about permitting government to make inroads into our liberty, but that's not the same as saying they should never do so. So whilst much of the hostility to government may be justified, some of the more extreme responses draw their rhetorical power from a rejection of government as such, which I think we should all unhesitatingly reject, particularly in a democratic or republican system, albeit with the Queen. I mean, I keep forgetting about her and her various dogs. More to tonight's point, civil libertarian extremism, camouflaged as the protection of civil liberties, does immense damage to the Republican cause. So we have the anxiety that an extremist position, no change on criminal justice, contaminates the whole public perception of civil liberties, and we have the additional anxiety that an almost like semi-anarchic mistrust of government, which expresses itself as a kind of hostility to all government regulation, risks leading the civil libertarian to be perceived as a kind of extremist. Now, the civil libertarian exclusivist is saying something different after 11 September, and I think it's more dangerous. It's been heard far more openly in government than in the past. It's less off the mainstream than it might have been before that date. And it's this. We've been right all along, they say. Our freedoms are for us, not the other. Now, as I've said already, the other has changed over time. It has been the union agitator. It's been the activist woman in pursuit of her franchise rights. It's been the communist. It's been the unemployed worker. It's been the Irish. Now it seems to be the turn of the foreign terrorist suspect, or maybe even the follower of Islam. He or she, the implicit argument is, has no place in our civil libertarian model, even if they live here. Our freedoms remain perfect, but they are only for us. The power of this embrace by the exclusivist lies in how it exploits the weakness in the Republican model, because it is a weakness. I indicated earlier that there was, and we need to confront it directly. An essential feature of the Republican approach is to empower government to be strong, to regulate where it needs to regulate, to control what has to be controlled. Now, that's fine when it comes to bus lanes, unhealthy meat, pollution, and so on, we're all for it. But what happens when this regulatory power, justified by the Republican model of government, is turned on the freedom of the citizenry and on the political process itself, and the executive of the day, eliding the issue of its own survival with the survival of the nation, uses its power to attack both those it defines as the other and also its political opponents, therefore contriving, in the words of John Ely, the well-known American scholar, to block off the channels of political change. Temperamentally, politicians who reach the top are trained to believe they are indispensable. If they thought for one moment they were not indispensable, they would go mad. And we equip them with a power which can prevent them from losing support to others. It's a very dangerous power, and it flows out of the Republican model. And it's the problem with the model that has led some to believe that we need to erect fundamental human rights barriers to prevent executive power acting in this way. Legislation passed since 11 September has certainly attacked the liberty of this newly defined other in our culture, the terrorist suspect, a terrifying thing to be described as, a far wider category of person than you might believe to be the case. We have de facto internment, wide-ranging terrorism laws, and recently an horrendous draft emergency bill, which I have to say, for moments, reasons I'll explain in a moment, has been watered down. Anti-terrorism laws in place already have the potential to subvert the political process, both here and abroad. The Terrorism Act 2000 extends to internal as well as external threats and covers violent political action wherever it might occur in the world. The question I want to end with then is the fundamental one for the health of our democracy. How do we keep alive the Republican perspective on civil liberties and the libertarian presumption of freedom, while at the same time both recognizing the need for strong state action against terrorist attack, thereby avoiding the libertarian fetish, but without falling into the exclusivist trap of drifting into an authoritarian state in which no truly radical challenge to the status quo is possible, and in which only a portion of the population enjoys a wide range of civil liberties? How do we manage to maintain the line between these two temptations? Well, I think we can, and more to the point, I think we are. I know it's unusual for a civil liberties commentator not to end on a forecast of doom and gloom. So maybe I should explain why I think there's still a chance here to do this and why I think we're doing it. First of all, I should get the law courts out of the way. I mentioned earlier a temptation was to create judicial barriers to prevent the excess of power by the executive. But history suggests, and current practice suggests, that the courts do not actually defend this Republican model in a situation of an emergency, and that they do defer to executive judgments about the needs of the nation based on the judgment about the survival of the nation. And we've had a succession of cases under the Terrorism Act which have actually upheld governmental power in this country, not least the decision by the Court of Appeal that the detention of only foreigners was in fact compatible with human rights under the Human Rights Act. And also we've had a decision by the Special Immigration Advisory Commission that it's possible to take into account evidence procured by torture rooted in a test of reliability. Not torture that's obtained here, but evidence that's emerged as a result of torture elsewhere. So I'm not so sure that the courts deliver that kind of safeguard, though maybe that's something for people to discuss. No, in my judgment, my final point, it's been the maligned political culture, frequently over-maligned, in which we find evidence of a civil society still alive to the values of freedom and political liberty. We have Soumi Chakrabarty coming here next month, and she's, as the leader of Liberty, the director of Liberty, has been to the forefront in this. So too have a handful of politically aware lawyers and journalists, the church, the professions, the Select Committee on Home Affairs, the Joint Committee on Human Rights. These political bodies have done well. They've continued to be protests. The detainees have not been forgotten. Parliament's dislike of the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Bill led to the insertion of what is called a sunset clause, forcing those clauses into oblivion after a certain period. Better to describe it, in my view, as a daybreak clause. And also led to the setting up of a committee of Privy Councillors to review that legislation. Now, in a most remarkable report just before Christmas, this committee of Privy Councillors, establishment figures to a man and woman, many of them former ministers, some in the Conservative government, came out and said that the internment powers in this country were an outrageous infringement of political liberty and should be brought to an end immediately. And they've scheduled the entire act to ensure that government needs to take this matter to the floor of the House of Commons. The same kind of vigorous political action secured major concessions on the government's initial proposals on civil contingencies. So the battle is worth fighting. Civil libertarians should not give in to pessimism, but the civil libertarian should be clear about what he or she means by civil liberties, and then, having clarified it, defend it to the full. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Provocative, stimulating, and brilliant as always. I was tempted to say to Francesca, follow that. But she will. Francesca, as you know, is professorial research fellow at the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. She'll be known to most of you. I'll ask her to respond to Connor's paper.
Thank you, Stephen, and thank you, Connor, for a really fascinating exploration of the meaning of civil liberties and its link to democracy, and I really mean that. But I have to admit, I feel a bit as if we're on reality TV. I mean, Connor, you and I have been discussing these issues on and off for so many years now, and quite frequently with Andrew as well, and many years ago, of course, before Stephen was a judge, with Stephen, I might add. And so I'm not entirely sure whether we're meant to acknowledge that rather a lot of people are watching us this time. I think you've taken us a long way forward from the sometimes banal characterisation of abuse of civil liberties and human rights to mean that virtually anything which the state does to interfere with individual choices or liberties. And I particularly appreciate your coining of a new categorisation of the republican tendency in civil liberties. Now, I must admit, I don't know about you, but when I first heard Connor say that, I thought he might be referring to the Bush Doctrine, which was set out by Bush in October 2002 as follows. Any time we've got any kind of inkling that somebody is thinking about doing something to an American and something to our homeland, you've just got to know we're moving on it. To protect the United Nations Constitution, no less. These are his words, not mine. And at the same time, we're protecting you. Which I think translates as, let's get the bastards before they get us. I want to begin with the hugely significant question with which you ended, which I would sum up in my own words as follows. If states have a duty to uphold civil liberties and human rights, what does this obligation consist of when it is third parties who threaten to abuse fundamental rights and freedoms, for example, by seeking to kill as many civilians as possible? And how is the state to fulfill this obligation without drifting into authoritarianism itself and curtailing the fundamental rights and liberties of, at a minimum, those deemed by the state to be associated with a threatening group? Now, let me say that I think this is absolutely the right question to ask, assuming you still recognize that as your question. This is, if you like, the big question as opposed to the big conversation for scholars of our generation and human rights activists of our generation. For if we're to defeat the Bush Doctrine of preemptive force, we must be heard to acknowledge the legitimate concerns about safety and security that lie behind it. But while it's not difficult from a human rights perspective to criticize Guantanamo Bay or our own anti-terrorist legislation, although it's hugely important that we do so and that we are heard to do so, what is much harder and what is much more of a challenge for us is to be able to develop a human rights framework that not only addresses what governments shouldn't do, but what they should do to protect our human rights from gross violations by others, whether others be states or terrorist groups or individuals. I'd go even further and suggest that addressing this question is not only fundamental to keeping the flame of human rights alive in current circumstances, but to mapping out what is distinct about human rights discourse, you note, not civil liberties, and its relationship to democracy. For the phrase human rights, it's worth reminding ourselves, as distinct from inalienable rights or civil liberties, was not widely used before the end of World War II. It was a term that took off in the wake of the Universal Declaration which bears its name. And it was this declaration, of course, which set the framework for all subsequent international and regional human rights treaties. Whilst many of the precise circumstances which led to the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or UDHR, were of course very different from the ones we face today, I'd suggest there were certain profound features in common. And for this reason, the drafters of the UDHR addressed a not dissimilar big question to the one we are asking tonight. It's important for us to appreciate, I think, that the UN delegates who drafted the declaration were not preoccupied with the same concerns as the revolutionaries or constitutionalists who shaped the earlier Enlightenment Bills of Rights, from the 1689 British Bill of Rights through to the French Declaration and the American Bill of Rights. These pioneers, these early pioneers, put the civil in the liberty by combining their quest for the so-called rights of man with their struggles for democracy. Drawing on the popularized theories of people like John Locke and Tom Paine, early civil libertarians established three related principles, I believe, which bears out Jeremy Waldron's categorization of civil liberties that Connor referred to. One, that governments which abused individuals' so-called natural rights to free thought and liberty should forfeit their legitimacy. They shouldn't be in power. It was a ground for revolution if they did so. Two, that meaningful citizenship of the new sought-for democratic republics, and they were republics, depended on rights to free speech and protest. And three, that concerns over due process and fair trial rights lay in the significant proportion of prosecutions by non-democratic governments for crimes against the state. This is the link between the fair trial rights and the other civil liberties, in my view. In this context, and it's very important to think back to this context, or indeed this context that exists in many parts of the world currently, the state was cast as the criminal who violated the natural rights to free speech or protest of the prosecuted, who became the victims. The prosecuted became the victims in such trials. But the backdrop to the drafting of the UDHR in 1947-8 was very different. The world had just witnessed the failure of constitutional liberties in the heart of supposedly democratic Europe to provide any protection whatsoever against genocidal murder and rampant abuse of the most basic rights and liberties. Today, being Holocaust Memorial Day, it's worth remembering that it was not just a question of an all-powerful state terrorizing its disenfranchised citizens, although there was plenty of that, but thousands of people all over Europe had colluded with the Nazi government or occupying power to deport or murder their fellow citizens. As with more recent massacres and attempted genocides in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Kosovo, the classic model of state tyranny was not sufficient to explain this. Conscious of the inhumanity that individuals had shown to their fellow human beings, under orders or otherwise, the drafters of the UDHR were concerned to develop, in my view, what can only be described as a set of ethical values which went beyond endorsing the principle of liberty and which addressed a more complex set of relationships than the individual to the state. The question they faced was therefore not unlike the one we are facing tonight. How do you preserve and build on the civil liberties that an earlier generation had won by reducing the power of the state whilst charging the same state with the responsibility of preventing individuals from destroying the rights of others? It's by responding to this big question, I would suggest, that human rights discourse starts to move towards the acceptance of what Connor identifies as the republican tendency in civil liberties, in which, as he puts it, there is a belief in the transformative power of the state to bring about a more equal society. Time prevents us from discussing the process by which the drafters of the UDHR came upon their tentative resolution to the big question. But suffice it to say, it lay in the introduction of three new values that were barely visible in early civil liberties course. With significant input, and it's worth bearing this in mind, from the non-liberal and non-Western discourses of Islam, Confucianism, and indeed socialism, these three distinct values were dignity, equality, and community. The whole of the Declaration, in my view, and consequently, in my view, modern human rights discourse as a whole, can be understood as the working through of the relationship of these three new human rights values with the traditional civil libertarian principles of liberty, democratic freedoms, and justice. As one of the prime authors of the Declaration, the French representative, René Cassin, was keen to emphasize, and these are his words, the UDHR was not a mere offshoot of the 18th century Tree of Rights. With dignity came the proposition that the state had to take positive measures to respect individuals' inherent worth, rather than just refrain from abusing their liberties. Article 22 of the Declaration, which introduces the economic, social, and cultural rights section, so radical in its day, of the Declaration, it describes these rights as indispensable for what? For human dignity. With equality, the drafters chose not just to stick with the Enlightenment formula of equality before the law, but to introduce the thoroughly modern formulation that everyone is entitled to the rights in the Declaration without distinction of any kind, such as race, colour, sex, religion, and so forth. Equal protection of the law and protection against any discrimination, including incitement, were also emphasised. Now, once it was accepted, if you think about it, that human rights values require states to proactively take measures to root out discrimination, then the concept of liberty was bound to change. It could no longer mean that everyone was free to choose who to rent their property to or who to employ, for example. If everyone's rights were to be secured in practice and not just in theory, there had to be limits to individual liberty. But it was the introduction of the idea that everyone has duties to the community. Everyone has duties to the community. In Article 29 of the UDHR, which takes us closest to addressing Connor's big question, and which most distinguishes human rights discourse from civil liberties, in my view. After much debate, the delegates introduced the concept of community with the explanation that it is only through the community that the full development of an individual's personality is possible. And this is written into, this idea is written into Article 29 of the Universal Declaration. The implication of this insight are profound. If human beings do not just need freedom to flourish, but a thriving community on which they depend, then it's inevitable you have to put limits on individual rights. And these limits are not just to ensure freedom for all, which is what equality achieves, if you like, but for something like the common good. The idea that society is more than just a collection of discrete individuals is a major and distinctive theme of post-war or second wave human rights thinking. It is the riposte to the Marxist critique that rights discourse should be written off as hopelessly egoistic and individualistic. But there is, of course, a resounding caveat to human rights limitations on individuals' rights and freedoms. A caveat which finally takes us to the link between civil liberties, human rights, and democracy, that axis of virtue that Connor so usefully discusses. In all human rights treaties, from the Universal Declaration onwards, any limitations on fundamental rights, as many of you here will know, must be lawful, must be proportionate, and must be necessary to achieve a prescribed goal in a democratic society. Although never precisely defined, this phrase, in a democratic society, is repeated over and over again in human rights treaties. Now, given that human rights are widely understood as providing a bulwark against majority rule, and are sometimes described as anti-democratic for that reason, where does this apparent circularity lead us? It seems to me that it at least leaves us with a framework with which to address our big question, one that civil liberties discourse on its own struggles to provide. Why? Because although human rights like civil liberties can be understood in functional terms as providing the openness and engagement necessary for a democratic society, human rights goes much further in setting boundaries to the outcomes of a democracy, not just the process. So in human rights terms, legislatures should not only be restrained from passing laws which unnecessarily imperil liberty, democracy, or justice, but they should be required to take measures which uphold the values of dignity, equality, and community, such as introducing social security, or preventing discrimination, or, for that matter, protecting victims of violent crime. In other words, in human rights discourse, the state is no longer necessarily in the dock as the criminal violator of individual freedoms, as it was in the 18th century civil liberties discourse, when it takes measures to deter violent crime and prosecute alleged criminals. In certain defined circumstances, it is in fact obliged to take preventative measures in the stated view of the European Court of Human Rights to protect an individual whose life is at risk from the criminal acts of other individuals. So in human rights terms, measures which fill gaps in child protection or the eradication of racial or domestic violence should not just be proofed for necessity and proportionality. They should be welcomed. They should be demanded, in fact. And by the same token, dare I say this, civil contingency measures may be something civil libertarians can live with, provided they are proportionate, but with the same proportionality safeguard, they are something human rights promoters in principle should welcome if they've not been updated for 50 years. But lest this be confused with a watered-down version of the Bush doctrine of get the bastards before they get us, it's important to keep emphasising that such limits on individual freedoms have definable limits of their own. In human rights terms, our protection can never be at the expense, as Connor has said, of obliterating the most basic rights and freedoms of a minority, however tiny, who are given no effective opportunity to defend themselves from the allegations of their accusers. For such people are also part of the community to whom we all owe responsibilities, Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair included.
Andrew Padifat, who is present executive director of Article 19, but has a long record as director of Charter 88 and before that General Secretary of Liberty. Andrew.
Thanks a lot. I had the advantage of seeing Connor's talk in advance, so I've been able to reflect on what he said and I'm just going to make a few comments really about some of the concepts he's put forward and some of the issues he's raised and then return to the concepts. And I found it a very interesting talk, and as Francesca said, it's the development of a dialogue that a number of us on this platform have been having for 15 years, and I guess if we sit in any camp in his classification, you're looking at a bunch of Republicans rather than classic libertarians, so that the libertarians are slightly absent on the platform, so maybe they'll speak up from the floor. And Connor, following Waldron, really classifies civil libertarians as being concerned with unrestricted freedoms, that is the state out of their life, a general concern with state power, and some procedural rights, particularly in the criminal justice system, which he didn't want to discuss in great detail. And set against that, those three areas, he's raised the concept or developed the concept that Waldron introduced of a Republican tradition of civil liberties, which values politics, public action, and sees the importance of the state as a protector of citizens' private interest against powerful private forces that threaten it, be they corporate, be they individual, and so on. The first thing that struck me reading the presentation was how local the concept of civil liberties is in my experience. Outside of Britain, and certainly outside of any common law country, I doubt very much whether the term civil liberties has much currency at all. Wherever I work, I tend not to work in Britain anymore. I work around the world, and people there talk about human rights almost entirely. They don't talk about civil liberties. They wouldn't particularly understand what civil liberties are, and it seems to me that civil liberties is a term that outside of a common law culture and a concept of freedom existing in the silence of the law doesn't have a great deal of purchase. And so I'm firstly sceptical about the use of the term civil liberty in the first place and query its long-term value in understanding the forces that face us in the world globally. Although I accept it has a very real resonance in political discussions in Britain and is therefore sometimes quite useful. And if I think of where the modern human rights world sits, and picking up what Francesca said, and for me the modern human rights world originates with Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech in the Second World War, and Roosevelt was no enemy of state power, as anyone who knows the history of the New Deal will tell you, or the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, they weren't afraid of state power either. They weren't civil libertarians. The whole debate in the origin of the modern human rights movement was not how do you defend people against state power, but how do you use state power? How does state power be deployed to protect individuals? How does it further human rights? What constraints should it exist under? What duties and responsibilities should the state have in the protection of individuals' liberties? And personally, I've always found human rights and human rights discourse more useful, more valuable, and more applicable to me than the civil liberties discourse, which is why I had quite a lot of problems with members of my board when I was the General Secretary of Liberty, who took a very classically civil libertarian approach to many of the problems that we faced. And the first thing I'd say about human rights is human rights is, by its very nature, not exclusivist. I mean, if there is an exclusivist civil liberties tradition in the way that Connor said, that's inconceivable in the human rights world. Human rights apply to anybody. You can't differentiate them by politics or by ethnic group or by gender or by other category. They simply apply universally to people everywhere all the time. So we don't have that conceptual problem of people saying, well, I believe in some human rights, but only for me and not for you. Once you do that, you've stepped outside of the whole discourse of human rights as it's developed in the last 50 years. I think the real problem is that we've allowed within the human rights world the language of human rights to become too narrow, too legalistic, and too focused on one aspect of the social problems that we face. Let me say where I think what the situation is in relation to terrorism and anti-terror laws. The state has a duty to protect and promote human rights. The state has an obligation to protect my right to life as a citizen, as a human being, so that I'm not blown to pieces by somebody who wants to kill me when I walk along the street. Equally, the state has a duty to protect my procedural rights if I'm suspecting of wanting to blow up other people who happen to be walking along that street. So the clash is not between human rights and security or civil liberties and the state, but between how the state can reconcile two potentially conflicting human rights obligations. One, the protection of the physical security of its citizens and the people in the boundaries of its territory, and the other, how does it reconcile and protect the procedural rights of those it believes are about to or have committed serious offences or threats to that security. If you think of the problem like that, then I think you have a much more useful way of measuring the effectiveness of anti-terrorist legislation, its compliance with those basic standards of human rights, whether it is necessary to limit or temporarily suspend people's individual rights or not in certain circumstances, because you've got a broad template against which you can set those individual problems. But we don't do that. And I was struck last week watching Sunrise on Sky, as I often do at the gym, because it gets me going on the treadmill, when they had an item about the latest government attempt to restrict the rights of young hoodlums on council estates to terrorise their neighbours. I don't even know what the particular proposal was, but that was the way it was framed on Sky. And they preceded the news discussion and item with secret video they shot on a housing estate somewhere. And that showed people throwing dustbins through the windows of tenants on the estate. It showed a young person lying on the street having his spine kicked in by a group of half a dozen other youths. It showed a bunch of kids, probably 12 to 13, jumping up and down on a car, smashing it and then setting it on fire, and so on and so on. All actual live footage, which will appear on cable TV later on in the neighbourhood somewhere. And right at the end, after then a discussion of what the government's proposals were, some reactions from the lawyers, comments from the Tories, they found a Liberal Democrat who had something to say, right at the end it said, some civil liberties groups have said this will threaten the human rights of the perpetrators, of the people who are accused of doing this. And I thought, well, there you are. You have pensioners being terrified on estates. It's happening. You have young people with their spines being kicked in. That's happening. You have people seeing their property destroyed willfully. That's happening. And this isn't a human rights problem. And yet one aspect of a government's response of dealing with that problem, that is how human rights is framed. And that's a problem. That's a problem for the friends of human rights, and it's actually an asset for the foes of human rights, because it narrows down the very meaning and range of human rights to a very small aspect of human behaviour. And I don't think that's what the original framers of the Universal Declaration had in mind when they set out the rights and obligations that belong to states in protecting and human rights. And the failure of us to embrace the broader understanding of rights has, I think, three consequences. First of all, if you think human rights are essentially about perpetrators, then governments simply see human rights as something to be traded away, to be repressed in the interest of public order and security, and to be sacrificed because they don't make for effective government, and you can't protect people's liberties and freedoms effectively if you preserve human rights. Many, many politicians now believe that. And many will argue that human rights are a nice thing in principle, but we have to sacrifice them in the name of expediency because we're dealing with this extraordinary threat. That's the first problem. Governments no longer promote human rights. Even governments, which I think Connor's right in saying, like the current one, within that Republican tradition, who have a history of making a whole series of human rights advances in this society. They'll lose interest in doing it. They're losing interest in doing it. The second problem, if we accept the libertarian opposition to the use of state power in this area, is that we actually lose the public argument as human rights advocates. Because when people feel their security is threatened, they value that security far more than they value the abstract right of a person they don't know. And we can't rely, as history tells us and as Connor's told us, on the courts to protect human rights when the going gets tough. You have to rely on political action, which in a democracy means relying on public opinion. And we can't afford to cede the battleground of public opinion to those who say human rights are only about perpetrators and only about terrorist suspects and nothing about the general security of the population. So the second reason why we have to challenge that is to win the public argument. And thirdly, and something that always strikes me, is that we become blind to the actual nature of the human rights problems that exist in a developed democracy like we live in Britain today. You know, if you said to people in Britain, what is the major human rights problem? I'd be tempted, if time permitting, to throw the question open to the audience. Most people I know would say police powers, detainees in Belmarsh, prison conditions, something to do with the repressive arm of the state, the police and the criminal justice system. What they'd be very unlikely to do is mention the condition in our children's homes, where children are routinely abused, raped, and sexually mistreated and have been for decades. They're unlikely to mention the treatment of disabled people in this country, which is scandalous in any institutional framework and is often appallingly neglected in a domestic framework. They're almost certainly never mention the position of the elderly in private and voluntary homes up and down this country, hundreds of thousands of whom are existing with various kinds of abuse, like having to eat their meals on a toilet because the care workers can't be asked to dress them and get them off that toilet at meal times, and so on and so on. And if you said to someone, what's the worst human rights abuse that you've come across in the last 5 years, it would probably be an arrest, conviction, criminal justice issue of some kind, a state action. It probably wouldn't be the abuse and murder of Victoria Colombier, carried out by private individuals, not caused by an oppressive state intervening in her life, but by the failure of the state in its duty to intervene and protect that child from the abuse that it was experiencing from her carers. And so what we miss is the whole realm of human rights abuses, which are rife up and down this country, which are taking place in the private sphere, in private lives, by private actors, but completely outside the realm of the conventional human rights debate, and certainly not on the horizon of the civil libertarians and the civil liberties debate and civil liberties advocates. So I'll suggest the real opposition is not between the libertarians and the republicans within the civil rights tradition, as Connor suggested, but actually between the civil liberties tradition, which says get the state out of our lives, and which originated in some 18th century concept of the state when it only was a repressive apparatus, the distinction between that and the human rights movement, which recognizes the state as having a constructive and positive role, a role that needs to be constrained and shaped by certain principles, but a positive role in enforcing and protecting the human rights values for all of us.
Thank you very much indeed. We have a little time for questions and discussion. It's clear that we're not going to be able to get away from the problem of terminology if, for example, we elect to use Andrew's definition of civil liberties as the libertarian, the individualistic view of rights, rights of which the state is the natural enemy, and human rights as the holistic view which includes everything that the state owes to the individual, then we're, I think, probably not talking the same language as Connor was talking in his paper, or Francesca does. But it may nevertheless be useful to recognize that whatever you call them, there are the two polarized views, the Republican, or at its worst, the state, at its sharpest, the statist view of the state as the essential protector of the individual, and the libertarian view of the individual as best off with the minimum of state intervention and interference. Where that leaves the right balance is a problem for governments, it's a problem for judges, it's a problem for every individual who thinks, and that includes all of you. Who would like to say something first? Could you identify yourself when you speak and keep your contribution, whether it's a question or a remark, to not more than 3 minutes? Is the microphone on its way?
Hello, is that better?
Yeah.
It seems that perhaps one way to reconcile this issue is to examine the statement that the purpose of democracy or the state is to protect our human rights. Could I have some comments on that?
I'll save these up. I'll ask the speakers to respond. But let's say a few more points or questions from the floor. Yes.
Thanks to the Human Rights Center.
Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm Niti. I'm a type 2 physician in England. Maybe physician without human rights, foreign doctors. Okay, thank you. It's a very rare sight to see an outspoken judge without wig. So, Mr. Stephen, I can call you not like a honor or some Stephen. Certainly good to see you without the usual.
What's your point?
I'm so sorry. Loud is the best medicine. Okay. The thing is, Mr. Stephen, the thing is, I get equal democracy when I go to, unlike the Florida, when I go to vote, whether it's a mayoral election or the parliament election. But the problem comes when I go to an academic meetings. I mean, in your royal, for you it's a royal college, for me it's a racist college. I get the human, Article 9 and Article 10 is being denied. When if I'm outspoken like you, I need to engage Article 5. So what happens? A young solicitor or young barrister or a young women in your profession, do they get equal rights? Or do they get human rights? And it may not be in your courtroom, but in your CPE. Because we think that the foreigners are being denied in this country. You talk about human rights, Zimbabwe don't have human rights, Saudi Arabia don't have human rights, but whereas when I come here, I don't get human rights. My union don't represent my need to expel me. Oh, Connor, sometimes he won't even allow me to talk here. So why? No. Is this color or it's content? What is?
Thank you. Yes, in the gallery.
Thank you. George Lesser from UCL. It's more of a criticism than a question. Now, the attack on civil libertarianism was well argued, but I'm afraid this is not the problem. Why? Well, because all these four liberties that Waldron identifies, they map out the area conceptually. However, we need to know what is common within these four ideals. Now, we can start the other way around. All these four areas that touch upon civil liberties, what is common is this concern for equality. We need to treat people as equals, with equal respect and concern. That's why you have guarantees in the criminal system. That's why there are things such as rights, freedom of religion and freedom of thought. That is why we give people one vote for each person. Each one person, one vote. It's out of the concern for equality. Now, if we start this way, you can actually resolve all the conflicts and all the potential tensions within that theory. And the problem is not whether there's any conflict between human rights, liberty, and democracy. Is what is the best way, the best conception of equality that would resolve them. Now, the third speech today was to that point. It asks, well, how should we treat people as equals? What is the best theory of equality? Does it matter more the right of procedural guarantees as against the right to life? Who should we give more due to? Who is more worthy of respect in each case? Now, this is a very hard task. It requires very good theory, very good moral theory, but this is the place where we should start, mapping out the area, historical tensions, the way that all these concepts evolved is relevant, but this is not decisive. This is where the discussion starts, with good moral theory. Thank you.
Thank you. Right at the back of the gallery.
Hello, my name's Carrie Thomas. I'd like to pick up on Andrew's debate at the end when he was talking about human rights issues for children, children's homes, the disabled and the elderly. And really it's how we make something equitable here. I would like to focus on the disabled and those particularly with mental health problems. And today we had a report in The Guardian about Rocky Bennett, who had been held down by nurses and his airways became blocked and he died as a result whilst he was being forcibly restrained. None of those people who held him down has to account for themselves. And we're at a point in governmental legislation at the moment. We're looking at draft proposals for new mental health legislation, which will give greater powers to restrain people and to compulsorily treat people, but not give patients greater rights. And I think this is a great contradiction on human rights. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Person next to you.
Hi, my name's Annika Westra, and I'm also interested in the draft mental health bill and the effect it will have on a lot of people's human rights. Would you agree that from the human rights perspective and civil liberties perspective and democratic perspective, that if you look at the draft, have any idea about the draft mental health bill, you'll see it as showing a very good example of government authoritarianism. You'll see it's doing a good job at curtailing the civil liberties of people with mental health problems. You'll see that many human rights are oppressed and taken away from this minority group of people, all because they're being taken away from a majority of people with severe mental health problems because of a very, very few that might become violent. And I think if you looked at this draft mental health bill in detail, it'll be a very good example of getting all these issues. The government's got all these issues wrong, and there's no even sign of conflict or partnership in the way they have put it forward. And it could affect one in four people, which is actually the general public being involved too. I don't know whether that's all I need to say, really. Would you agree that it does go against all these issues?
I think that contribution, like the very first one, and the number in between, highlights yet again the tension between the democratic process and the protection of civil liberties. There's very little doubt that some of what the last speaker is referring to, the mental health bill, is a response to press coverage of a handful of extremely alarming cases, but a handful which represents the smallest possible fraction of all those who suffer from mental health problems. Majoritarian democracy tends to respond to the headlines, and that's one of the reasons why some kind of a governing set of principles is required even in a democracy. That we have in one form in the European Convention on Human Rights, which enables even the parliament of this country to be held to account in the Strasbourg court. But it represents, I think, a negotiation, a continuing negotiation between equally respectable and equally valid strands of political and civil society. I'm not sure that there's any single formulaic relationship that one can say is the right one between them. Anyway, that's simply to tread water for a moment. Somebody else has a hand up down here, yes.
G. Leslie, surely the main point is, rather than discussing schools of human discourse, we should be looking at how the state has undeniably been removing our rights without due cause. Our right to demonstrate has been highly circumscribed. The terrorist provisions, civil emergencies, etc., etc. Basically, most people have thought that this has been a government which has been looking for justification, for removing, as it were, our human rights. It was planned beforehand. So it's not exactly as a result of the terrorism. Wouldn't panel like to discuss whether or not our human rights are surely not undeniably being restricted when GM protesters, Roe protesters, all the environmentalists, all such people can now be deemed to be terrorists and then can have action taken against them. This is basically the thin end of the wedge with regard to the recent pieces of legislation with regard to the attack on civil or human rights, rather.
I'll take one more contribution. If there are two hands are now proliferating. A minute or so each, the three people who've got their hands up. The lady with the, in the white jumper first.
Hello, right. I'm unhappy about the last speaker who, you redefine human rights. First of all, you throw civil liberties out the window, then you want to just focus on human rights. But then you redefine human rights in a very, very wide way, including the elderly and children, etc., etc. And with all my care and worry for the elderly and sick children, etc., I think that doing that blurs what human rights really are. And basically will end up resulting in a new balancing out of human rights in which the human rights that I want to protect of freedom of speech and due process, they'll just be balanced out completely. And I think blurring that is dangerous and unwarranted. The rights of elderly people and sick people are important, but they needn't be called human rights. They could be called as easily something else.
Thank you. Could you pass the microphone to your neighbour, who I think had their hand up? No, then speak to the person down here.
Thank you. My name is Michael Sharapatka. I'm a second-year IR student. I have the following question. Don't you think that to expect international institutions to hold governments accountable for human rights violations is absurd given the anarchic nature of international relations? Thank you.
Good IR. Right, well, if that isn't food for another full hour's discussion, I don't know what is. But we'll ask the speakers to take that on board. I did say three. There's one more hand up here. That'll be the last.
My name's Shelley Brownlee, and I'm a third-year law student here. I'm just wondering what the panel think. Is there a case for a human rights commission here in the United Kingdom?
Right. I'm going to ask the speakers to respond in reverse order. Andrew, would you like to go first?
Yeah.
Not to respond to everything, but to those things that you think are salient points.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think the purpose of the state is to protect human rights in that way, but I think it's an accepted part of international law that the state has a duty to protect rights. I mean, I guess in relation to the colleague at the front who talked about the government planning this assault on human rights for a long time and people who are environmentalists being potentially arrested as terrorists. I mean, I think there have been some serious erosions over time of a number of procedural rights in the criminal justice system. I think there have been some serious issues in the anti-terrorist legislation, which have marked the British system for a long time on and off. Against that, I think you've got to set the passing of the Human Rights Act, which has actually strengthened and given support to a whole wide variety of human rights that we didn't have before under the old common law system. So in that sense, you could say the current government has actually extended human rights quite dramatically as well and given new powers for people to challenge abuses of their rights. And I think it's if I can say this politely, a hopelessly paranoid view that you're putting forward, that it's the traffic is all one way. I think the traffic, as with any government of this kind of persuasion, is always quite a complicated picture. And there are some very positive things that it's done and very negative things. They have, as Jack Straw once said, a left-wing set of cufflinks and a right-wing set of cufflinks, and you never quite know which shirt he's wearing at any one time. whether it's... The other question I was interested in was, well, I had two actually, one from the woman at the back. I actually think it's impossible to restrict human rights to free speech and due process. I mean, I don't think the Universal Declaration of Human Rights does that. I don't think any human rights instrument does that. I think there's an argument that you can extend human rights too far and invent new rights, but to say that children, the disabled, and the elderly have the same set of core human rights to have their to be free of torture and inhuman degrading treatment, they have a right to life, they have a right to due process in the homes in which they're put. It's the core rights they have, regardless of who they are as people, that I'm concerned about, and that's the dimension that I think I was trying to argue is often neglected by focusing on certain categories of people whose procedural rights are violated. And lastly, in terms of holding governments to account in an anarchic international system, I think the interesting thing is of how in that international anarchic system, how much holding to account of governments does actually take place through the mechanisms of the United Nations, the special rapporteurs, the commissions, and the conventions. Given what could be the case, it's amazing how much effort governments put into getting good reports from their fellows and actually the diplomatic effort they make to try and pass the processes they've been able to sign up to. So it's far from perfect, but compared to any other time in human history, it's a more functioning international system than we've ever had.
Thanks very much. Francesca.
Thank you. The suggestion that the purpose of the state is to, Michael May, to protect our human rights, a possible means of reconciliation of our arguments. Well, certainly not the Bush Doctrine, is it? Bush Doctrine and the more traditional Republican doctrine than Connors would be that the purpose of the state is to protect our security. So I love the idea that the purpose of the state is to protect our human rights. I mean, even I wouldn't go so far as to say that's the only purpose of the state, but I would agree with you that it is a way of reconciling these different tensions, because if the classic Enlightenment civil libertarian position was that states are illegitimate if they don't protect our human rights, the kind of modern post-war human rights discourse takes that a leap forward and says it is a duty of the state to protect our human rights, and it's certainly one of its major functions. The two women at the back who talked about the draft, I think it's a draft mental health bill, is it? Forgive me, I'm not familiar with it. And I think, as Stephen says, it does usefully raise the point about the tensions between the civil liberties and, to some extent, the human rights tradition that has supported the idea of a democratic framework, and the anti-democratic goal, which is very much a human rights one, to put limits on what the legislature can decide. And our own resolution of that, to some extent, was through, as Andrew mentioned, the Human Rights Act, which, of course, is a little bit of a Bill of Rights not like any other, because the courts can't overturn acts of Parliament under it, which does leave a certain amount of responsibility on parliamentarians. And for many of us who were involved in the model in the Human Rights Act, we were very concerned that there should be a parliamentary route to, at the very least, monitoring legislation under the Human Rights Act, which was not simply infected by the executive. And that route was miraculously achieved through the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which is a select committee of both houses, which looks actually at every single bill when it's going through the House, and certainly in detail at draft bills. So if you haven't been in touch with the committee, I recommend that you get in touch with it directly. And that leads, of course, onto the question about the Human Rights Commission. There was no commitment to introduce a Human Rights Commission when the Human Rights Act went through. But after lots of nagging and waning and whining and lobbying behind the scenes, the government has now made a commitment to establishing a commission for equality in human rights. I'm privileged to be on the task force that's looking up at how to do it. And one of the issues that some of us have confronted, in fact, was the very one that Andrew so eloquently spoke of in his address, and relates to the point that you were making from near the front about what are, in fact, human rights. Which is that human rights are essentially a framework of values to address abuse of power. I mean, that's what I think they are. And therefore, it is not a question of, not being concerned about free expression and abuse of the trial process, but it is about being extremely concerned about the fact, for example, that whilst there are, 16 people whom we are all extremely concerned are detained under the new anti-terrorism legislation without trial, there are several hundred people with learning difficulties who've been detained for 40 years without a hearing, and which the government agrees should be out of those long-term asylums, which is what they are, but there's no place to put them in. And we think that there is no meaningful understanding of human rights which doesn't take both those concerns in equal regard. And that's what the commission hopefully will begin to address.
Thank you very much, Francesca.
Thanks. Yes, Shelley, I won't add on the commission. I have an open mind on it, and I've heard some very persuasive arguments there from Francesca. Michael, you didn't need to say you were from IR, I think, if I may say so. I think if you'd been around the 17th century and old Tom Hobbes had been around, he'd given a talk, he'd have said, Mr. Hobbes, I mean, this state of nature is fine. Why do we need this Leviathan business, So I disagree with you, and I think the human rights thing is, and the regulation of the international international relations is here to stay, I think, and hope. Michael's first point I'd like to link with something that Andrew said. The purpose of democracy, protect our human rights. This is where I think the value of this civil liberty stuff comes in. Outmoded though the words are, and I sort of apologetically started in that mode, they capture something important about democracy. And this human rights thing is so protean and so kind of vague that in a sense I'm trying to kind of put my marker down for what it means. And I was thinking civil liberties can kind of help inform what we mean by human rights. And since I believe that civil liberties is indissoluble from a commitment to democracy, then to some extent I'm saying that the purpose of civil liberties is to create the space for a democratic system which will produce our human rights. And then you were the sixth speaker, but I don't think I caught your name, critique of Andrew's extensive approach to human rights. I haven't actually pushed it here, but let me give you my model, which is that these civil liberties create the space for political engagement. And that then is where the language of rights might or might not be deployed. So might the language of fairness, so might the language of justice. And that produces a legislator which then enacts laws which guarantee rights. So these rights come in then as the consequence of a political process. Now, I know there are problems with all of that. I'm the first to agree there are. But nevertheless, there's a vision there of a system which includes rights at the end of the process and human rights as a rhetorical device for the delivery of those outcomes of which we approve. Now, I mean, that avoids me having to say whether I believe as a phenomenon in human rights, and perhaps in many ways I do. George's, third speaker, equal respect and concern is an important insight. The libertarian, though, says get the state off my back. The problem is, when you get the state off everybody's back, do you leave things as they are, or do you actually try and change things to make everybody equal? My problem with equality of respect, which accepts the status quo, is that in practice, there is horrendous inequality that is accepted. And you don't tamper with it, because to tamper with it, you have to interfere with the liberties of the privileged. So I'm anxious that if you say that the libertarian is committed to equality, then perhaps the libertarian means the preservation of the status quo, equal treatment of all now with no state involvement, and that seems to me to lead to injustice. So maybe we do need to tackle the freedoms of some in order to achieve the equality of all, in which case there is a division between them. On human rights, Andrew said, the human rights language makes this kind of discrimination impossible. And I'm very anxious about this ruling under the Human Rights Act, which says that it's justifiable under the Human Rights Act to distinguish between the kinds of people you can detain indefinitely and the kinds of people you cannot. It seems to me that is absolutely subversive of the human rights message that everybody is entitled to the same treatment. And yet it's now in our caseload as a justifiable under human rights restriction on liberty. And so whilst in theory I'd share your point of view, Andrew, in practice it doesn't always work out like that. I won't add much to what Kerry and Alexia said. Like Francesca, I'm not really on top of the draft mental health law, but it wouldn't surprise me. And what it shows is maybe also the issues about the rights of the disabled, the rights of children, is what you might call in my language an exclusivist approach to civil liberties, where we're actually parking these people outside the process. And we're not really extending to them the respect, the dignity, and the rights that we would give to ourselves. Significantly, none of them has votes. So maybe there is a link here between freedom and engagement in the political process. Finally, because Stephen's reminding me of the need to sum up, and it is the last point, the fifth speaker, rights, political rights are very important. The right to demonstrate being removed without due cause, etc., attacks on people who are protesters as terrorists and so on, very important. Precisely because they are important, I want to keep the language available to be able to express how important it is when it arises and not have that language confused with language that applies to other areas like liberty and criminal justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. We're now so close to the wire that any reflections I might have had and wanted to give will have to wait for another day. I've learnt a great deal from listening. I'm sure that you have. It's been a very stimulating evening. Our thanks to the speakers, our thanks to all of you for coming, and I hope that whether you opt for the concert or drinks, you enjoy the rest of the evening. It's in the Robinson room that the drinks are.